Spoken word.
A taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene.
Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning and welcome to the 3CR Spoken Word program. My name is Di Cousins and today I'm talking to the writer Grant Caldwell. Welcome, Grant.
Thank you, Di.
And I'd like to acknowledge that we're recording on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and I pay my respects to elders past and present. So, Grant, you've just produced a new book, The Soundless Sound, which is a collection of haiku.
That's correct.
So tell me, how did this book come about? How did you discover haiku?
Oh, man. I think I started reading haiku back in the early 80s, maybe the 1970s. I had been writing poetry for some time and short fiction, and I was working on a novel, an auto-fictional novel. And back then I wrote what I thought were haiku, but later realised they were very bad haiku, or they weren't really getting to the essence of it. But my very first poem that I can recall ever writing, I think, was a haiku without me even knowing it, and it was a visual poem as well, but it could break into three lines. Although three lines is not the traditional form of haiku, but it's the form that English and a lot of Germanic languages shape it into, for reasons I won't go into here or right now, but. The poem was about the glass of water on my bedstead, which was it was ubiquitous. It was there all the time because I used to drink a bit, and alcohol dehydrates, and have a glass of water by your bedstead. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this, and it's a good idea to have some glass of water handy. So I woke up one morning and I was looking at this glass of water and I wrote, "A glass of water sits still, clear, stable, solid, collecting dust." And this was a kind of reflection on myself at the time. I was teaching economics or accounting and bookkeeping and commercial law in a secondary school, and it was very boring. And I didn't like what the education department was doing to the students and et cetera. So this was it was only later that I realised that this, you know, when I got into haiku and I started to understand it, that I reflected on this poem and realised it could be broken into three lines. And some of those early poems were accidentally 575 syllables, but they weren't intentionally so.
And let's talk about what a haiku is, because there are lots of different ideas. I have met people who have the view that a haiku is a collection of syllables which are matched to the first line having five syllables, the second line having seven, and the third line having five. So it's a kind of an artificial grid, and you kind of whack your syllables in there, and it might be just a coherent sentence, but it's just a structure. So what is a haiku?
Well, I could probably talk for 4 or 5 hours about what a haiku is, but I can tell you what it isn't. saying that it's 575 syllables in the English language, or indeed in French, or any Germanic language, is a complete error. And it goes back to the Japanese traditional form of haiku, which indeed was 575 sound units in the Japanese language. But Japanese sound units, or mora, vastly different to English or Germanic syllables. For example, the word Nippon, which is the original name of Japan, or what Japan, the real name of Japan is, has five Japanese sound units, but in English it has two. So there are a lot more nuanced syllables in the Japanese language. So this is something that has been talked about by people who know. And what the problem with this error, which exists throughout the world outside of Japan, is that when people start writing haiku, or they read haiku, they focus on this grid and miss the important elements of what a poem called a haiku is, or can be, or can involve. And thus the poems are shallow, insubstantial, but they all meet the 575 syllable principle, which makes people happy. Now, some people say it's a good grid for people learning haiku, and I disagree, because it starts people off and it's hard to break them of this habit. I had students I used to teach who had the rhyme habit. And it took weeks of hammering to get the rhyme habit out of them, to make their poems not sound like metronomes. This is what Ezra Pound said in early 20th century, when they broke from rhyme, and I think meter had gone already. Maybe it was meter they broke from, and what Wordsworth had broken from rhyme. He said, we no longer want to sound like metronomes. And they were following the French movement of free verse, or verse libre. And this all happened back then. That's where free verse came from. There are still people today who write in rhyme, in verse, rhyme, and even metre. And I had an Irish guy come and tell me my poetry wasn't poetry, because there wasn't any... He didn't hear any rhyme or metre. This was in 2007 in Ireland.
Right,
I wish I'd said to him, where have you been the last 100 years? But I was more polite than that.
Yep. So let's go back to the essential qualities of a haiku. As I understand it, we're happy to be corrected, a haiku has a visual awareness, so it's located in a particular space and time. Often there's a seasonal reference, but it's not essential, and that seasonal reference would vary between country and country, and also that there's a sense of something about the moment being kind of realized or crystallized in the haiku. How would you describe the essential elements of a haiku?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's a question that's central, but it's you use the word often and sometimes, And it's good that you use those qualifiers, because they're very apt, because there are no rules. Billy Collins, American poet, said something about the rule, that the haiku has rules, whereas free verse doesn't. He is wrong. There are no rules in haiku. There are principles. And these can be played around with, as all principles can be, and they can be applied or not applied. And I think in learning to write haiku, it's important to understand these principles and learn them, but not go around trying to jam them into every poem you write. If you're aware of them, they come through the poetry as you write them, and as you correctly observe, when you're writing about the moment of observation, these principles can infuse the poems. And not all the principles are in there, but they're the sort of things that, as I say, infuse whatever you write. And when you say the moment, this is something that's also misinterpreted, because it implies that you can only write on the spot. which is not true at all. Basho and Santoka and all of them and the great Grant Caldwell, they all polish their poems at a later date or write them. I mean, I make notes and things, but sometimes late in the evening I'm sitting down, I'm thinking, what did I see today that sticks in my mind? And I remember something, and I can make a poem out of that, you see. So I'm writing it about the moment, but in retrospect. And that's fine too, you know. So, I mean, there are no rules about, oh, we can't write that because it's not now, you know. It's just silly.
Yeah, so it's not always en plein air. Painting tradition where you have to be in the field painting the tree when you see the tree.
But you don't have to write about trees either. You can write about people. You can write about a cockroach on the floor of your lounge room, you know. You can write about what you see on television.
Yeah, the whole world is the field. Yeah, so there's a principle in haiku that is probably worth discussing, which is something about the changing and the unchanging. What's that principle?
That's the ever changing and the never changing. There's various ways you can call it, and it's a very important principle in Japanese poetry. It's really at the forefront for them, but it's implied in all kinds of poetry, I think. And what it comes down to is there needs to be something universal and timeless in what you're observing. But at the same time, that's the never changing. But at the same time, there needs to be something about now, something contemporary, a feeling of the present, as well. And these two mixed together. If you don't have, if you only have one of them, then the poem lacks. And Basho said that a poem is only writing that only writes about the now and the present and doesn't have this sense of timelessness or the never changing is fleeting, which was his word, which is a great word, and it's true. And a lot of poems, not just in outside of Japan, but I've read a lot of poems in translation from contemporary Japanese poetry, have this problem. That they seem to be, that they don't have the sense of the timelessness, of the universality of the never changing in them, and it's the most difficult area to learn about. But Basho also said, don't follow what the old poets or elders did, seek what they sought, which is a fantastic phrase. And all of the haiku poets going back into history, back to Basho and even before him, because it doesn't start with him. He formulated the idea, but that kind of poetry goes back even further than the 17th century. They all trained as Zen monks. They were all Zen Buddhist monks. This was like living in Ireland in the 20th century. A friend of mine, the Irish poet, who I won't name to him, I won't embarrass him, but he's a well-known poet. He trained as a priest, and I said he got out of it when he was a young man and became a poet. I said, why did you train as a priest? He said, that's what you did when you were a young man in Ireland. You either trained as a priest or you went in the army or you became a teacher. And it's the same in Japan. You know, becoming a Zen monk was very, very much expected of a lot of people, especially with that kind of inclination, and people in the samurai class kind of thing. So, but most of them left the monasteries because of the rigidity of the rules and all of this stuff. And can you see the parallels here with poetry? You see, and you know, and they also broke with the traditions of poetry and changed and rebelled, not only against the traditions of the monastery, but against the rules of poetry as they existed, because it was very traditional when you go back, just as it is in the West.
So I'm talking to Grant Caldwell about his new book, The Soundless Sound, which is a collection of haiku. So, Grant, let's get to some haiku. And would you like to also kind of point out some of these principles, like unchanged or always changing and never changing? You know, we'll read a few and then look at where those elements are.
Yes. As I alluded earlier, in writing haiku, I'm never conscious of the principles that I've learned or that I'm aware of or that I hope to understand. So it's an issue for me to then analyse my own poetry and indeed find what you're talking about. And I might...
I might
be horrified to find that they're not there.
It was just a suggestion.
It's a great suggestion, and I don't mind having a go. So there's a poem. The book is not signposted at all. This is an in-house stylistic thing, but the book is broken into a number of sections. There's four sections of using the arbitrary four seasons, which are useful, but they're not exact. And we know, the local Wurundjeri people see seven seasons in Melbourne, and most people who live in Melbourne would say there's probably 25 seasons and even more these days. But anyway, as an arbitrary sectionalising, it's useful, summer, etc. And then there's another section called Senru. Now, Senru is a form of haiku, but it's usually about human nature and about humans, and it's often amusing. And then there's another section at the back of the book, there's a number of series based on my travels in different parts of the world, but also observing a car park very near, a church car park near my house, near my apartment, which has provided me with a lot of fascinating notions for poems, and there's a few other areas as well. So I'll just, as a preface, I'm giving you this, and I'll go to one poem in particular. It's very short, which is instructive in a way, because I'm just looking here. It has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 syllables. Now, for me, the less English or Germanic syllables, it kind of resonates with me. I find it kind of exciting. And what I think explaining that excitement is about, in an attempt to do that, is I think it provides more space for not just interpretation but thinking. And, I think photography, especially black and white photography, is the closest thing to haiku. But the one thing photographs can't do is they can't give you sound, or they don't do it readily. Now, this poem does not have sound in it, I don't think. But anyway, I'll read the poem and then I'll try and interpret it. Summer. Fallen bark on the path. Now, of course, in Australia, the trees don't shed their leaves in summer, but they shed their bark. Okay, so this brings it down to a locale, and this is what Basho and the original origins of poetry were, that the original haiku was a hoku or haikai, which meant opening verse, and it was the opening verse of a game, of a poetry game that a lot of different poets would write, and they'd write it. The master would write a hoku, opening verse, and then the next poet would write a response, and it would go around. They'd write a kind of a collaborative poem. But the opening verse or hoku of the master, the supposed master, was what lasted through time and became as an individual poem, which is what Basho developed. So this poem gives us the locale, which is Melbourne, Victoria. It's here somewhere. Could be in Royal Park, Now, the fallen bark is autumn, sorry, summer, and it's, for me, it suggests the ephemeral nature of nature, that things change and they die and they go through this movement. And it's on the path, and now we know the path is an indirect metaphor, right? And this is a thing about haiku, which it does not, or one of the principles is not to use direct metaphor. But I break that rule every now and then, which you can. But generally, so here we have an indirect metaphor. So we see the metaphor because we're poets, and most people will understand the path does not necessarily just mean the thing you walk along and see a piece of fallen bark on and ants crossing and whatever, but it's, you know, the path of life.
It might be the mystical path, like the Taoist path.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also
the Buddhist path, or the Hindu path.
Christian path.
Anybody's path.
Anybody's path, their path. Yeah. You know, the Tao, translation of the Tao, the Taoism, is the way or the path. So there's a bit of Zen in there, a bit of Taoism for us. And then there's movement in this poem. Is that?
Yeah, that's really good, and it shows that every haiku needs to be sat with, you know, for a moment. You can't just look at it and say,
move on.
There's a bit of a story about a sky, and you have to kind of sit there and reflect a little bit and let it sit and see where it goes. I liked one of yours in here about the traffic lights.
Yeah.
Shall we read that?
At 3 a.m., the traffic lights signal each other.
Now, there's something very special about this idea, the traffic lights are signalling each other, like they're sentient or something. Where does that idea come from?
Well, the Shinto religion recognises the sentience of inanimate objects. But I think Taoist principles also do this. And I've thought about this. It's very interesting. I think part of these kind of principles is that they're instructive for living. And if you can understand a stone, then you might find it easier to understand the person. It gives you that sense of trying to put yourself in their position. And this is something else Basho said. He said, to understand the pine, you must become the pine. And so you become the thing. It's not objective or subjective. You actually move out of yourself into whatever it is you're observing. So this is this sense of sentience in inanimate or otherwise thought insentient objects or things. And not just the church car park, but I can see the traffic lights, some very significant traffic lights not far from my apartment, and I can see them, and I can see cars crossing all day and all night, well, most of the night. Although in the very early hours in the morning, remarkably, there's sometimes no traffic, would you believe? And this is in the inner city. And I noticed, but the traffic lights were still working and signalling their red and green and yellow, and then it came to me, they're actually having a conversation. So it's, I almost wrote the last line as, instead of signal each other, as signal to each other. And I had a lot of trouble deciding whether to put the two, but I don't think it needs the two, because they're signalling each other. And they're having a conversation in their Morse, you know.
Yeah, well, it's another way of seeing the world, isn't it? You know,
yes.
Kind of,
and that's what we need to do.
Deeper way, yeah.
We need to see the world in another way, in order to understand it. I mean, you know, a rigid view of the world, which is the direction it's going in, but let's not go there, is part of the problem.
It is the problem.
Well, it is.
And I think also having a sense of the sentience of the world in a way takes us to an Indigenous point of view where country is... I think there's a quote, you've got a paper on country, on Aboriginal point of view of about country, and it's not that a person owns country, it's that the country owns a person.
Mm.
So would you like to say something about this paper on the connection between First Nations country and Basho's enduring principles for the writing of haiku?
Yeah. The impetus for that paper, it's published in Axon, the Canberra University Journal. It's an Axon Creative Explorations. And it's available on the web. But the inspiration or the impetus for that paper was that one of my PhD students, when I was working at the university, wrote something in their paper. They lived amongst the people in northern Australia, and they said that they realised that a lot of Westerners write about places other than their own locale because they don't understand their local locale, their own locale. And it struck me, and I felt terribly guilty for a while, and I thought, well, that's what I'm doing. I'm writing about, you know, I'm using Japanese poetry form, and I'm living here amongst a civilization that's 60,000 years old or so. What am I doing? So then I looked into it, and I thought, well, these principles I'm learning from the Japanese poetics are the same, sorry, are similar and are coming from nature just as all civilizations, all cultures do. All cultures base their culture on their observation of nature. And so I looked into Aboriginal First Nations people's art, which is where you find the people doing it the most, and I discovered all these connections, all of these parallels and ideas about and wonderful stuff. And so I developed the paper around that and brought in these parallels of the connection from Basho to Aboriginal artists and writers, poets.
Okay. Now, we've got to stop there because the program is only half an hour long. And we will continue the discussion in part two, which you will be able to hear next month. So my name is Di Cousins, and I've been talking to Grant Caldwell about his new book, The Soundless Sound. Thank you, Grant. I hope you can join us to continue the conversation.
I do too, Di. Thank you.
This has been the Spoken Word Program.